From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch, health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney.
Well, in the new book, A Walking Life, author Antonia Malchik asks essential questions at the center of humanity's evolution and social structures. Who gets to walk and where? How did we lose the right to walk, and what implications does that have for the strength of our communities, the future of democracy, and the pervasive loneliness of individual lives? Antonia delves into a wealth of science, history, and anecdote from our deepest origins as hominids, to our first steps as babies, to universal design and social infrastructure. Her book shows exactly how walking is essential and how deeply reliant our brains and bodies are on this simple pedestrian act and how we can reclaim it. Antonia, welcome to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you walked about 2,000 miles while you were writing this book. I think that we all experience sort of a revolution when we walk. We see so much more, we experience so much more, and then we're going to do it all the time and we don't, but you did it. What did you find?
I did walk about 2,000 miles, so about 1,000 miles a year, which sounds like so much, but averaged out, it's about 2.5 miles a day, which...
That still sounds like
40,
a lot.
40 minutes. Yeah. It's funny, these days, I really started to pay attention to, if I wasn't intentionally walking everywhere, you know, how many steps did I get in? And it was appalling. It could be less than 100, so barely even records it on a step counter. And it's just because our lives are so sedentary, while at the same time, how we get places is pretty much always in cars. And that has a lot of impacts, as you mentioned in your introduction, on our physical health, our mental well-being, and the structure of our societies and the health of our communities. I found for me that walking that much, it's hard to even put into words what a difference that has made in my own personal life. But it is something I am definitely committed to doing for the rest of my life after having done it.
I notice that something in your book that you bring up that I hadn't even thought about really, which is ridiculous that I hadn't thought about it, but our bodies are designed for walking, and they have been that way since the beginning of time, basically. And you kind of outline this really nicely. Can you do so for our listeners?
I will do my best. Not being a paleoanthropologist, I do try to describe it as best I can. But it's true, and there are no stupid questions when it comes to something like walking. It is so integral to everything about who we are that it's something that most of us never think about. And I don't think there's a single subject I covered in this book that I thought about before I started digging into it. So, you know, we often think that it's our brains that really make us special, that make us human. But brains didn't start getting big until about 2 million years ago. But fossil record shows that somewhere between 6 and 4 million years ago, hominins began to walk upright on 2 feet. And then somewhere between 7 and 4 million years ago, this started to become a regular thing, what they call habitual bipedality. So the way that we walk on 2 feet, it's really precarious if you stand up and just take one step and pay attention to how your foot is moving and your knee is like a pendulum and your hips shift weight. And for a moment, you're balancing on this one little point in your foot and your big toe. It's absolutely unique to us human beings, Homo sapiens. And at some point in the last 7 to 4 million years, that became more of a habitual thing. And nobody really knows why, but it does seem to be really integral to how we developed as Homo sapiens.
Antonia, I have a friend who turned, for his 60th birthday, he decided to give himself, the present he was going to give himself was he was going to walk he was going to do a hike in every state. And so it's taken him a year and a half, and he just came through 2 weekends ago to Park City and hiked with me. And it was really fascinating for him to explain the origins of this gift to himself, which was he was going to go, you know, do a hike in every state, and it was going to be sort of a conquest and a, you know, and an experience, a challenge. And what it turned into was he realized that he got to go and visit friends in every 50 state and do a 6 to 10 mile hike with them and delve into catch up and conversation. And it was really fascinating how that changed for him. And that's a big part of what you're expressing in your book.
Oh, I love that story. And it fits right in with so many people I spoke with who had done a really long walk. I talked with a young man in Denver, Jonathan Stalls, who walked across the country for 8 months. And now he runs some walking groups in Denver, but he also just keeps doing these long walks because he's a little hooked on them. And I talked to another woman who had walked from London to Geneva for peace. And no matter whom I talked with, everything that came up was about connection, both connection to the planet, to nature, and to other human beings. And when I first proposed this book to my publisher, I did not put connection and community and loneliness in that book proposal. But when I started doing the research, that is what I kept coming across. And it has to do with how we encounter one another on a daily basis. Conversations that are had when you're walking just seem to flow much more deeply and easily than they do over the phone or sitting. And it is fascinating to me how much this evolutionary gift has given us in the development of our social lives, how we relate to one another, how it relates to kindness, how we think about other people, how we think about people who are different from ourselves. It really seems to open up that part of being human in ways that I certainly didn't expect when I started researching.
Yeah, it is fascinating what happens when you slow down. And like Lynn, I spent a lot of my early years, were actually probably about 25 of the 27 years that I've lived in Park City, moving through the environment a little more quickly than at a walking pace. I was either running trails or biking on trails. And since I have, well, to use the hike that I did with my friend that I referenced, I found 3 crystals on the trail on that hike. And I have a friend who has always found crystals. And I always wondered how that happened until I slowed down enough to start walking and seeing what was right below my feet and what was around me. And it's an incredibly different experience. Both of them are wonderful. I love trail running and mountain biking on the trails, but I have learned to love to hike the trails. And I just find that kind of a fascinating evolution or transformation. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, that kind of happened with my kids. You know, kids, they love to move so much, and they go all over. So when I'm like walk with my kids into town, they will roam up and down hills and into yards and all over the place. But they much prefer biking. You know, kids like to move fast. And when we started walking and biking to school every day, it took about a year before my daughter decided she actually preferred walking with me. And the reason was because we could have conversations. So, for example, this morning, right before we got on this phone call, I took her to school and she wanted to bike today. So we biked, but then halfway through, she was trying to tell me about a dream she had. And so she said, can we stop and walk? And we stopped and walked. And, you know, children's dreams are just as strange as grown-up's dreams. So it took a while, but it was just fascinating for us to have that time together. And I think when they grow up, I do kind of wonder what a difference that kind of connection and time will have made in their lives.
Yeah. There is a couple who walks through my neighborhood. They're very active. They ski and they bike and they do all of these sports, but you see them most evenings, unfortunately, as I'm driving by them, arm in arm walking through the neighborhood. And anyone who lives in my neighborhood, I know, knows what I'm talking about. And we all go, oh, we should be more like them. And I always wonder how much deeper their relationship is, how, you know, what they talk about, what they see. And I guess my question would be, what do you think keeps us from doing this? Obviously, it's our car culture, but Is there something more that we can work on?
I think there is something more. As you know, in the kind of the center part of the book is really digging into the 1900s and how we lost access to walking through car-centric design that was not so much chosen as imposed. And now there are just millions and millions of people who have no access to walking or no access to safe walking. I saw this Twitter thread a while back of journalists from Europe, and they were joking about how when they book hotels in America, they now look at Google satellite views or street views to make sure that they can walk from the hotel.
Exactly.
Because they didn't realize that it was possible to put a hotel in a place that you could only access by car. So it's definitely deeply embedded in our design. But, you know, I think a lot about our relationship with technology and this question about do the technologies that we create serve us or do we serve them? And I think we're facing another one of those big shifts with digital technology right now. And so often when it's the case that the technology is there to be served, perhaps, you know, for profit or for research or for other reasons, what happens is that our lives hurry up a lot and we lose so much time. When you start walking to get places instead of driving, or even if you start biking to get places instead of driving, you have to think about time differently,
mm-hmm.
how long it takes to get somewhere, how you spend your time. And most of the time we're just, I don't know, as humans, you know, most of us have a work ethic and we're trying to take care of our families and do a good job and live good lives. And we're trying to keep up with everything while we're doing that. And I don't know if we're coming to a point where we're realizing how unsustainable that is just for our own selves. But it does often feel like that. And people are looking for just a new way to be, a new way to spend time. Just saying, you know, I can't do this anymore. You can't be checking your phone all night long and driving an hour and a half to work each way. It's just no good for human beings. And so I'm very interested in how we take back control of those technologies and figure out ways to very intentionally think about the kinds of lives that we want to live, what that would look like individually and also as a society.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Antonia Malchek. She has written a book called A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom One Step at a Time. I wanted to ask you about the Camino de Santiago, the pilgrimage from France across northern Spain to Galicia and Santiago de Compostela. If you ever talk to anyone, and I've not done that, but who has walked a certain portion of that, amazing things happen to them, great shifts, connections with people. And it's become this thing that, you know, instead of just going for a walk in our own community, you know, we fly across the globe to go do this walk. And yet it is something so special. And I'm sure you're aware of many other pilgrimages like these.
There are a lot. I didn't realize how many they were. I actually just got an email from someone in Michigan, I think, who's going to walk St. Cuthbert's Way in Scotland. And I have a quote from St. Cuthbert on my website, and I only found out about it from the Scotland Outdoors podcast. They had done an episode on this pilgrimage to this, you know, several hundred year old St. Cuthbert's shrine, I guess it is. You know, what's fascinating about the Camino and probably any other pilgrimage, but you're right, the Camino de Santiago is the one that comes up most frequently. Everybody I talked to who had done that had, as you said, a really profound experience. All the people that I talked with had walked it after a death of someone close to them or after a divorce. I certainly think, you know, a divorce is very much a grieving process. It's the death is something that's very central to most of us. And it was almost a little frightening, actually, what they came up with, because what one woman told me, she walked it after her brother had died, and she said she doesn't think that you can do it for less than 3 weeks, because what she found was that the discomfort and the time was really essential to her uncovering the reality of that grief that she was living with. She said, you know, you're uncomfortable, you're walking all day, and then you're staying in these hostels, and the food isn't really very good. And so, you know, there's nothing to ease it. And she talked about grief as just being exposed within her as this enormous weight and this presence. And when I talked with this group of Marine sniper veterans in Montana who run a hiking group for vets with PTSD, the central to their whole project is the weight of grief and the weight of guilt. And I think when you do a walk like that, you have to be very, you know, I'm using the word intentional again, but you have to know what you're getting into. I was hiking recently with a friend, and that evening she was talking and saying, hey, we should do the Camino de Santiago together in a couple of years. We can just bring the kids and I'll be fine. I said, no, you know, like from everything I've heard, you do not want your children with you on that journey. You are going to need to be very present for yourself.
That's really fascinating. So do you think that there's kind of a self-selecting mechanism that occurs on these big sort of epic hikes where there is a component of grief that is common to most of the people who are doing it?
I'm not sure. And I couldn't say absolutely mostly because I didn't end up talking to anybody who had done it for another reason. It was very coincidental. People would just hear what I was working on and they would tell me their stories. I did read a story about a man in Canada who ended up walking about 600 miles because he'd struggled with alcoholism for so long. And he had tried over and over and over every method he could think of to deal with his alcoholism. And he finally just set out his door and just walked north. And wow. 600 miles later, he'd come to a new understanding of himself. Pretty much everything we do in life is self-selecting in a way. To do something like a big walk, you have to have time. You've got to have some sort of funds, although that's not always necessarily true. There's been a lot of sort of pilgrimage walkers throughout history, like Peace Pilgrim was a woman who walked for many years. Planet Walker, a man named John Francis, walked for, with 17 years of walking and 22 years of silence, or the other way around.
Wow.
I should check that. And those two people, Planet Walker and Peace Pilgrim, I don't think they took any money with them. They didn't make a living. So it really depends on what kind of person you are and what your expectations are. I personally would love to do something like St. Cuthbert's Way in Scotland or one of the Norwegian pilgrimages, but I have young children. And so I've thought about, well, what if I did like 10 miles a day in town and just made a pilgrimage for a month within my own town? But I think that's just a lot harder to commit to. And maybe you have to get out of your own space and where there's expectations and where things are familiar in order to really commit yourself to that.
Well, I know when I was a kid, we were members of the Green Mountain Hiking Club, my parents, and they would drag me along on these hikes. And for the first 15 minutes, I thought it was the greatest thing ever. And then for the next 45 minutes, I would whine so ridiculously that it ruined the experience for everybody. So I know how kids definitely can change the whole experience. But you wrote an amazing essay about your daughter, and I think it's maybe the same daughter that you referenced earlier. So to walk is human, to reflect divine, and I would just put it out to our audience. It was printed in High Country News on May 13, 2019, if they want to Google search it and get a little taste of, you know, what you present in your book. And this will definitely set the hook because it's just a phenomenal quick story about what happens when you connect in a way when you're walking. And, you know, that other part of the other flip side of the grieving process and how that's important to the vets, there's also building resiliency, which you hit upon in your essay with your daughter. And I think that's kind of what you concluded with, was how you had this opportunity to build a more resilient child and a more resilient human being and more resilient relationship.
Well, I hope so. I really enjoyed writing that essay. If you don't go read it, it's just about a walk I took with my daughter. Well, not an intentional walk. We were just walking home from school, and she was planting unicorn eggs. She would make these snowballs, and she was putting them in snowbanks and said, this is a unicorn egg, and this is a dog egg. And, you know, she has a tremendous imagination. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps coming back to me as adding a quality to our relationship that I have no idea what kinds of effects it will have over time, but I hope it gives her something that really builds resilience as a human being. And I also think that walking and walkability, just on a more practical level, you know, we talk a lot in our culture about resilient communities now, especially with climate change coming faster. You know, we really need communities that can not just withstand things like wildfires and hurricanes, but can withstand those things socially, where people know how to come together, how to work together, how to help one another. And walkability, you know, building a community that is walkable in that way is really essential. Just having people closer to one another, being able to see one another all the time. You know, there's no self-selecting groups when you live in a community other than a small town in Montana. And it's we think of it as a bubble sometimes, but it's really very mixed, actually. And I appreciate that about it. I appreciate having my assumptions and ideologies challenged just by people I see every day on the street when I'm running an errand, walking downtown. So I think resilience is really at the core of walking and walkability. And hopefully as humans, because one of the things I keep coming back to is, you know, so often we look for solutions in our lives. And for example, with something like grief, you know, eventually you get over it. And I don't think people ever do get over grief, especially really profound grief. So walking through that and with that helps us know how to live with it within ourselves.
Mm. I was surprised. I know that you've lived in all kinds of cities all over the world, Moscow, Vienna, Sydney, Boston, and then you've returned to Montana where you grew up. And somewhere in your book, you say that walking in this small town that you live in is a way of life. And it's funny that I always do so much more walking in cities and then in rural areas, so much more driving because everything's so far apart. And I'm just wondering where you live and what kind of town is it if walking is truly a way of life?
I live in Whitefish, Montana, which is very close to Glacier National Park. So it's you know, it's a tourist town, it's a ski town, but it's a very deeply connected community. People are very committed to community engagement here. And when I was in high school, it was relatively walkable, but I actually lived out of town. And when I came back after about 20 years, I found that there had been all these community movements to build bike and pedestrian trails.
Yes.
And now we have a 30-year plan, and I'm on that committee that works on those things, and it's, you know, all tiered about priorities and what you can purchase through easements and all these different things. But they dug in again and said, no, this is something we want. This is what we want our community to look like. We want people to be able to walk and bike places. And I know you've talked about biking a lot. I do bike a fair amount, but I broke my tailbone when I was quite young, maybe 8 or 9. And biking is not so comfortable for me. So I use it when I need to get more fast. But I that's part of why I prefer walking otherwise. But yeah, I mean, I lived, when I first started writing about walking, I was living in upstate New York, and it was much more rural, and mm-hmm. that's part of the whole point of the book, that's part of what set me on this path, was that I couldn't walk anywhere, especially once I had kids, I was completely dependent on the car.
I'm familiar, very familiar with Whitefish, and Whitefish, much like Park City, is sort of separated. Whitefish is separated by that bridge that goes over the railroad tracks. And quite often people would never, I mean, they might walk in one side of town or the other, but, you know, connecting the two is something that is evolving and taking a lot more time. We have that in Park City where we've got the downtown core and then we have Kimball Junction, and it's really not very far apart, and there's a bike path, and I'm seeing people more and more connecting those two dots. And do you see that in Whitefish?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the same thing. We do the viaduct over the train yard does have a separated sidewalk on either side. But they, again, in that 20 years, they had built a bike path that goes, it's a little further out, sort of goes around the rail yard and then under a bridge along the river. And people use that all the time. I just went for a walk on it with a friend yesterday, and it was busy. And actually, we use it heavily for 4th of July. We take our family down to the beach for 4th of July, and it's packed. It was like a mile and a half, and it was just completely thronged the entire way. I do see people more choosing to walk and bike. And I think it's partly because of, again, the town committed to building that infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And partly just, you know, as I'm sure you see in Park City, we get a lot of people moving here from other places. And in part, they choose Whitefish because of that kind of connectivity. Like, they look at this town and they feel like this is a good place to live. They can send their kids out on bikes. They can walk to school. I just meet so many people who, actually a lot of people who were tired of the hurricanes and looking for another place to live and willing to risk the wildfires and the smoke for a good connected community that they felt was resilient and a good place to raise their families. And so I think you get a lot of those people who actively want that kind of lifestyle.
That's nice. Well, just to end on this note, I just sent a copy of your book to my aunt who lives in Big Fork because she plans to, for her 80th birthday next year, do the Camino. It's all a very nice tie-in,
wow.
So I know she'll be inspired by you.
That is exciting. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. The book is A Walking Life, Reclaiming Our Health and Our Freedom, One Step at a Time. Our guest, Antonia Malchik, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both. It's really a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. If you missed part of the show or want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab. We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts. You can find them under KPCW and the individual show name. So look for KPCW The Mountain Life and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.